imaginary friendship of meddling with writing. But Étienne de la Boétie did die in 1563, only 32, leaving behind a handful of writings on the subject of political intelligence and power that Montaigne revered. "I know no one who can be compared with him," Montaigne writes in Of Friendship, an early essay. "If you press me to tell why I loved him," he says, "I feel that this cannot be expressed except by answering, because it was he, because it was I." Love, they say, is a constant interrogation. Montaigne says it differently. Friendship feeds on communication. But love is not an answer to anything. Friendship of the sort Montaigne speaks of and experienced is a harmony of wills, he says. Being together, getting lost in each other's thoughts. It was windy in Sarlat, the narrow streets crammed with narrow shops stacked with tins and jars of goose liver pâté, whole alarming lobes of pale livers in their shrink-wrapped jackets, looking as if they might start pulsing outside the plastic. Annette took my picture in front of La Boétie's birthplace, my windbreaker billowing out as if I had been force-fed too, my face seeming to grimace. But that was from the glare of the sun. In spite of Gustave Sobin and his vestiges, after we left Sarlat, we didn't stop at the museum for the Lascaux Caves. But I made a sharp turn off the road when I saw notice of the Château de Milland, the grand property of Josephine Baker, who was born in St. Louis in 1905, reborn in the freedom of Paris in the 1920s. She bought the chateau after the Second World War, filling it with her rainbow family of adopted children. We wandered around the giant stony place, hardly any other visitors that day, the gardens and lawns vast, yawning, a whole caged area given over to birds of prey, falcons and owls, eagles, hawks. The website makes it all look like Disneyland. Cheery and bright, offering exhibits and events for children. But when we were there, it was a shell of memory, a large, forlorn photo of Josephine Baker sitting on the steps by the kitchen the day she was evicted from the place. She was broke, her dream taken from her. Still, her enormous, glorioso smile, her lithe body on the postcard I bought. Her radiance, her bravery. She was awarded the Croix de Guerre for her work with the resistance, was made a chevalier of the Légion d'honneur by de Gaulle. Her indelible image, no matter what she lost, is evident in the postcard photo. Those famous faux bananas strapped around her bare waist, like a ring of male trophies stiff with excitement, to be encircling her flesh, her lissom form breaking all the rules. You feel the transgressive thrill even now, when there seem to be no rules, at least not for nudity on stage. A visit to the scandalous Josephine Baker, free of St. Louis, shimmying her danse sauvage across France. She not only got away from segregation, she achieved the Midwestern elsewhere. This was the right prelude to visiting Montaigne's tower, he who displayed undisguised, naked envy in the essay, as he listened to the description of people living naturally, naked and unabashed in that other world which has been discovered in our century, wishing that he could strip naked in his writing, the only way to write. Montaigne's chateau, huge and somehow haughty, is a separate building from the tower. It was completely reconstructed after a fire in 1885 damaged it. The original chateau built by Montaigne's grandfather. The family was mercantile, fish and wine. Only a couple of generations ennobled, his mother apparently from a Spanish converso family. Any visit to Montaigne's tower is not about the chateau in any case. He maintained he had no interest in domestic arrangements. Unlike his beloved father, Pierre, who spent his life making improvements to the vast place. Montaigne's widow was the last of his family to inhabit it. It remains, as it always has been, a private residence, whose we didn't know, though as we approached the entrance to the tower, an SUV pulled up, crunching over the sand-colored gravel entry area across the way. Three people, a man and two women, got out and entered the place as if they had pulled up to an overwrought suburban McMansion, loose-limbed in jeans and windbreakers. They didn't turn toward the tower. I think we were both startled to see how simple the visiting arrangements for the tower were. At a little outbuilding, almost a hut, a young girl had pointed the way to the tower, down a vaguely tended path with a hand-lettered sign, Tour. It seemed that we could just wander in. Annette said I should have it to myself first, go in alone, La Tour. There were no other visitors around. I climbed the staircase, past Montaigne's private chapel that took up the dark entry level, niched with an altar, a shrine-like cavern. And finally, I stood alone in the round room, his library, the light-filled chamber where it all happened. Once ringed with books, the stony enclosure where he devised his pieces, some shorter than a page, some long enough to make a chapbook, the writing he called his essay, thinking it was a throwaway word. The windows never had glass, and he refused to outfit the library with a fireplace. Imagine the cold in winter, in order to safeguard his books. The lines of wisdom he had inscribed on the ceiling in Latin, and some in Greek, had been re-inscribed in modern times in a restoration effort. The room was surely emptier, no books, than he knew it. His desk, or a desk, was positioned near the back wall, centered across from the windows on the other wall. A chair pulled neatly up to the desk. Nobody around. No forbidding sign, no ribbon across the chair. I sat in it, feeling slightly criminal nonetheless, or just silly. It was a long way to come to sit in a chair he'd never sat in, regarding an empty room with words on the ceiling I couldn't decipher. I wandered over to an opening at the side of the room and checked out the adjacent alcove where he had allowed a little fireplace, a cramped space to warm himself. This was the room, a sign said, where he slept. To the side, a kind of chute, a peephole down to the chapel so he could hear, even see, Mass without going down there. So the tower wasn't a study. It was almost a bachelor den. What do they call them now? A man cave. Except his was a tower, rising, not sinking into the ground. The chapel, the fact of it, surprised me. That the habits of religion, the old cult of Catholicism, not the new freedom of Protestant individual faith, mattered to him so much. He built liturgy into his privacy. This first modern man, this man we claim as a skeptic. He was a skeptic, and also a believer. He bridged the gap. He lived above with his books in the unheated tower, and he tended faithfully the rituals down there in the candlelit dark where mystery abided. On the walls of the alcove bedroom, I made out what was left of the painted frescoes, naked nymphs and godlets mostly, bundles of chipped floral decor, and the graffiti of earlier visitors, boldly scrawled Emma, 1882, and Pierre, 1920. and someone whose name and message I couldn't decipher. The date, 1989, the most recent I found. I looked out the window of the alcove to experience, or think I was experiencing, his view. A great blossoming marronnier, part of an allée of lofting chestnuts marshaled along a gravel path leading to the tower where I was, where he had been, with or possibly without chestnuts, or these chestnuts anyway. Nearer by, just below, a triangular, untended parterre garden, where it was easy to imagine herbs in careful arrays. That parterre garden sent a brief thrill through me. That, I thought, could have been here when he was here. Could have been what he looked down upon. Because surely he ate well. He tells us he loved rich sauces, delicately flavored. I turned back toward the main room, his writing room. I wanted to take some descriptive notes, hoping for an insight for the book I am, writing, an earnest essayist acting the part. Notes, the ineluctable consequence of one's greatest inward energy. The parterre of herbs was a start, but what else? Turning quickly, gaze angled down to the notebook where I was drawing the shape of the triangular garden. I misjudged the doorway, an earlier century, a smaller scale, and smacked my head, hard, into the stone wall, just above Pierre, 1920. You do see stars, or bits of white spinning that you could take for stars. Then, in my bell-ringing, star-shooting brain, I remembered, how had I forgotten, that Montaigne had whacked his head, too, colliding with another rider, momentarily knocked unconscious, slammed off his horse as he rode this wooded property. He was taken for dead as his men carried him, insensible, back to the chateau. It is one of the few recognizably memoiristic vignettes in the essay. A scrupulous reconstruction of a pivotal episode. A bit of story in the midst of all his pages of musing, pondering, reflecting, wondering, what used to be called philosophizing. He started his project in this room in imitation of the ancients, his beloved and much memorized classical writers, especially the Stoics. His belief, the title of an early essay, was nothing less than that to philosophize is to learn to die, life's essential lesson. The early essays after his retirement to the tower, after Étienne de la Boétie's death, after his own little death when he was knocked off his horse, the death from which he returned. All these early essays are about how to die. Dying with honor. Remember that? The airless airplane. The delivery room nurse stroking my hand. You holding the other. You aren't dying. You're having a panic attack. That's how Montaigne started. With death and its approach. Why did he honor this crashing moment so uncharacteristically with narrative? Well, it was a near-death experience. But even more, it was that most literary of experiences, unbiddable, decisive. The turn that allowed him to pierce to the core of the imagination, perhaps for the first time. In being knocked off his horse, he experienced the doubleness necessary to empower personally voiced writing. He experienced the fall, but he also observed the fall. Both. In separate but related strands of consciousness, he experienced and he saw the experience. The shock of this double register galvanized him to note the parallels of experience and observation. It was a kind of conversion moment. No wonder that most notorious conversion, St. Paul's, is represented as a fall from his horse. Neither the fall nor the horse is mentioned in the Bible, but this is the standard image of his change of heart, as if the violence of being knocked down from a height were the only way to express it adequately. In a sense, Paul's fall inaugurates the Christian era, a tumble from a smooth power ride, a thump out of the tribal self into a vision of a united world. You get knocked off balance, off your assumptions. You see stars, or what you take for stars, because anything this overwhelming catapults you into poetry, into metaphor. Your life changes, is changed. Even in our homely cliché, we speak of being struck by this or that. The point is you see, a fresh kind of seeing that feels accurate because the self is not, for once, a subject, not a weight you're lugging around, a slave to experience it must either endure or enjoy. This self is revealed as an instrument that can render, if not reality, then the experience of reality. The poetry of experience fastens to the reportage of the world. To express experience accurately, you must, paradoxically, be knocked out of yourself, knocked out of the inevitable narcissism and egotism that is our narrative lot, the smallness of the self. This quicksilver experience has been given by literature and psychology the lackluster label, detachment. Or as Keats called it, also fastening on an unwieldy phrase, negative capability. By which he meant in a letter to his brother that one must be capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And how is that done? By acquiescing to the leisure that apparently is so elusive, but is the key to the life of the mind. It is impossible to corral this experience in a name, a term, but once felt, there is nothing, not even love, to compare. Montaigne's younger brother had been hit on the head too, that tennis ball to the temple. He didn't experience, so far as we know, detachment. He died of the blow. So perhaps Montaigne had an astonished, even slightly grateful, guilty sense of dumb luck in surviving his fall because, unlike his brother, he came too. But surely he registered as well, his description of the experience proves this, the significance of his head wound. It gave him a new, enlarged consciousness. In his essay, he found the purpose of this self, to see and then to say. The personal essay was born of a smack upside the head. It is a cruel irony, is there any other kind, that Montaigne's purposely evasive word for his writings, essay, has become the dread, dreary term associated with freshman English, the term paper, the school theme. Is cigarette smoking harmful to your health? Discuss. Welcome back to school, children. Describe your summer vacation. And until quite recently, try to tell an editor who has professed to admire your novel that you have a book of essays in the drawer. It was long the genre that dared not speak its name in the literary marketplace. Not Montaigne's fault. His book was an immediate bestseller. He thought he had liberated writing, or at least himself, from literary formality to be wild, untamed, eccentric. The last thing we think of now when we hear the word essay, that domesticated homework pet. He could just as easily have called his pieces his whatevers. His use of the word essay was meant to be just that offhand and undefined. What he had in mind in his attempt, that word again, attempt, try, essay, was to renew the springs of the first-person voice bounding across the field of what we keep calling, against our uncertainty, reality. But reality and individual experience are exactly what's smacked together in the head, then on the page, in the essay. The personal and the public find perfect register for the length of the thing, the length of the try. Americans in particular love the first-person voice. It's no coincidence that our greatest poem is Song of Myself. We also seem to favor first-person narrators for our classic novels. Call me Ishmael. You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. And Fitzgerald, of course. After Gatsby's death, the East was haunted for me, like that, distorted beyond my eyes' power of correction. So when the blue smoke of brittle leaves was in the air, and the wind blew the wet laundry stiff on the line, I decided to come back home. Or maybe we don't love the personal voice. We just can't help trusting it. It feels authentic to us, a people given the charge in our founding document to pursue happiness, that individual enterprise. It may be our greatest fiction to believe the personal voice is more authentic than other narrative modes. We'll take it, most of the time, over omniscience. Not only because we are a notoriously self-regarding people, but because the first-person voice opens the narrative door to speculation and reflection, not to knowing, but to wondering. Perhaps we don't just want a story. We want to know how it feels, how it seems. We want the story of thinking. How much of Moby Dick is story, and how much a vast tract, an ocean of essay, waves and swells of speculation attached to the adventure tale of the great white whale. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. Another poetic parent of the personal voice, speaking in her sidelong way. Tell the truth, but tell it slant. Famously, rather coquettishly, Dickinson also said, I'm nobody. Who are you? That apparent self-revelation, really a self-screening, and its waggish question, display the economy shared by the personal voice in lyric poetry and the personal essay, two forms up to the same business. Of course you're nobody. So am I. But that fragile voice reveals more than a self. It holds the mirror up, not to itself, but to the world. The essay is a solo dance, a private pirouette, its glowing footstep emerging onto the public street, as we saw it that rainy night across from the Sorbonne, you holding the black umbrella over me as I snapped the iPhone, while you took shallow breaths, telling me to take all the time I needed. To stay. If I neglect to take my flashlight up to the monastery chapel for vespers, I will regret it later when sloshing blindly through puddles left in the rutted dirt road by the recent downpours, I stumble back in the dark to my hermitage. Hard not to stumble over the word rising like a medieval hiccup in the middle of my smoothly ticking postmodern life. It's a note I've just found in an old journal from a week-long retreat I took several years ago. Unlike Montaigne's Tower, there's no private chapel in my study at home. Home. The week-long retreat interrupted my own life down there as I thought of home, or thought of you. You were still here, or there, waving from the porch as I streaked off, the dog by your side. I was on a mountain in California thinking my thoughts, or rather trying not to think them for once. I was living not simply away in a geographic sense, but out of time, out of modernity, in a monastery over the great western coast. Though I'd come halfway across the country from Minnesota, I wasn't really traveling. I'd come here to stay put. Meanwhile, the world revved along down there and inside me too. So many choices all jumbled together. We have chosen a problematical name for ourselves. We are no longer souls as we once were. Not even citizens. We're all consumers now, grasping all the stuff every which way. Only connect, E.M. Forster, who was a modernist, instructed. A few generations of only connecting, and here we are, grabbing and stuffing. Order isn't our thing. We aren't the ladies adhering to a careful system. We aren't Mendel, cycling through the holy hours, tending generations of edible peas season to season. We definitely aren't Montaigne, retreating to his chateau. But still, that was the idea of the week. Retreat. What a strange fin de siècle we were passing through when I went there, fearful, terrorized, badly shaken the second year of the new millennium. Montaigne retreated to his tower in his perilous times. But for us, the word tower has an ominous meaning. The towers came down. Strangely, after all this time of being a country, a great country, Americans still prefer the idea of a future to the idea of history. We resist the limitations of history, its overwhelming weight, the denial of self-determination. We're in charge, aren't we? The only superpower left, we said for that brief entre-deux-guerres period, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to the fall of the Twin Towers. The vanity of imperial glitter rubs off on us, a gold dust the world longs for and resents. We've even elected a leader with a fixation on gold and gilt. We can't help preening. We've created ourselves. We're nobody's memory. In a way, the idea of the future is our history. The filmy future is a can-do place, our natural habitat, whereas the past is distressingly complete, full of our absence. We seem to know that if you take history too seriously, you'll never escape it. In place of national memory, we have substituted the only other possible story form, the dream. And the essential thing required of the American dream has always been that it must remain a dream, vivid, tantalizingly beyond reach. Just the dreaming of it, which costs nothing, absolutely nothing, except every cent of our imaginative attention, inflates the soul, fills it, rather than fulfills it. We wish to be free, whatever that means, and we know that memory, personal or civic, does not promote freedom. Gustav Sobin felt he had to leave America to hold a bit of Neolithic bone, to find human memory. That is history. Memory tethers. I was living a week, almost two, tourist time again, in a niche of memory. Cultural, not personal memory. It was Lent, and I had come to California on retreat, was given a hermitage, a small trailer, prefab, wood-paneled, tidy. A cell, as the monks call their own hexagonal hermitages that surround the chapel farther up the steep hill. The idea is not prison cell, but honeybee cell, a hive busy with the Opus Dei, the life of prayer. For those days, I was following a way of life balanced on a pattern of worship, trailing back to St. Benedict and his 6th century rule for monasteries, and still further back into the Syrian desert, where the solitary weirdos starved and prayed themselves out of history their own mystic way. Benedict's rule drew all that eccentric urgency into the social embrace, into civic life, and finally into history. He took the savage hermitage of the Levant and trained it into the European monastery, made a center out of the raw margin of the early desert recluses. The convent, after all, says frankly what it is, a convention, part of the social compact that claims order as a minion of tradition. The monastic day in California in the early 21st century, like the monastic day at Monte Cassino early in the 6th century, is poised on a formal cycle of prayers that revolves with the seasons, the same office of hours Gregor Mendel shaped his life around. A system still rolling along. It divides or connects the day and night by a series of communal prayer liturgies. This day, like all days, is a memory of the day that preceded. The day is a habit, the hours reinscribed as ritual. The days softly folded into seasons, each with meaning, feast and fast, sorrow, jubilation. Memory, habit, ritual, those qualities that do not perhaps sustain life, which is elemental, fiercely chaotic, but a way of life, bound to time with the silken ties of, what else? Words. The West murmurs, trying to locate itself. The East breathes, trying to lose itself. The Buddhists are down the coast highway at Tazahara, meditating silently, eating intelligently. A simplistic distinction, not entirely accurate. After all, the heart of Western contemplative life is silence, and the East, in at least one central practice, chews the word, the mantra. Still, Christianity is undeniably a wordy religion. Lectio Divina, sacred reading. The ancient practice laid down by the early patristic writers is alive still today. It is part of the daily routine here. Augustine, whose confessions I brought along, is the most passionate exemplar of this practice, not simply one of the West's great writers, but its greatest reader. The year is 397, and he is composing the West's first autobiography in North Africa, creating the genre that lies at the core of Western consciousness, substituting in place of the ancient idea of the story, the modern literary idea of a life. The omniscient authority of the tale told around the campfire turns to ash in the burning cry of the first-person voice. Augustine is, like every memoirist who follows him, hot with his subject. He's inflamed with the account of his fascinatingly bad life turned mysteriously good. But he only gives this story the first 9 of the 13 books of his confessions. Then, without explanation or apology, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, the work glides smoothly into an extended meditation, call it a long essay, on the book of Genesis, as if this too were his life. In fact, the movement from his life to his reading isn't smooth. It's ablaze, too. The narrative becomes more, not less, urgent. His story for Augustine is only part of the story. There is a clear logic dictating the form of the confessions that unites the account of his life with his reading of Genesis, though this is not a logic we moderns see as readily as his late 4th-century readers would have. Having constructed himself in the first 9 books of the Confessions, Augustine rushes on to investigate how God created the universe, how God, that is, created him and all of us, all of this. Reading, therefore, is concentrated life, not a pastiche of life or an alternative to life. The soul pondering is experience. Augustine, great-grandfather of Montaigne, his autobiography Striving Toward the Essay, poses his questions, wonders, meddles with writing. Lectio is not reading, as we might think of it. It is for Augustine, as it was for Ambrose, his teacher, and for these California monks in their 21st century cells, an acute form of listening. The method is reading, words on paper, but the endeavor is undertaken as a relationship, one filled with the pathos of the West. The individual, alone in a room, puts finger to page following the word and attempts to touch the elusive Lord last seen scurrying down the rabbit hole of creation. In the beginning, God created. Augustine, grappling with Genesis in his study, is more heated than Augustine struggling famously with the flesh. He invents autobiography not to reveal his memory of his life, but to plumb the memory of God's creative act. My mind burns to solve this complicated enigma, he says, with an essayist's anguish more intense than anything in his revelations about his own history. He understands his life as a model of the very creation that is beyond him and in him. He writes and writes, reads and reads his way through this double conundrum, the mystery of his own biography and the mystery of creation. He makes the central, paradoxical discovery of autobiography. Memory is not in the service of nostalgia. It is the future that commands its presence. It is not a reminiscence, but a quest. How bizarrely truncated the modern notion of seeking a self would seem to Augustine. Autobiography, for him, does not seek a self, not even for its own salvation. For him, the memory work of autobiography uses the self as the right instrument to seek meaning, that is, to seek God, a.k.a. ultimate mystery. The one who, when asked to give his name, says, I am that I am. Augustine takes this a step further. On the first page of the Confessions, he poses a problem that has a familiar modern ring. It would seem clear that no one can call upon thee without knowing thee. There is, in other words, the problem of God's notorious absence. Augustine takes the next step west. He seeks his faith with his doubt. May it be that a man must implore thee before he can know thee? The assumption here is that faith is not to be confused with certainty. The only thing people can really count on is longing and the occult directives of desire. So, Augustine wonders, does that mean prayer must come before faith? Illogical as it is, perhaps not knowing is the first condition of prayer rather than its negation. Can that be? He finds his working answer in Scripture. How shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? They shall praise the Lord that seek him. Praise, he decides, antedates certainty, as well as faith. Longing, not belief, is the core of self that unfurls its song, the instinct to cry out. Poetry. This is where the Psalms come in. They are praise. More, they are relation, full of the intensity of intimacy, rage, petulance, and joy. The sheer delight and exasperation of close encounter. This is the spectrum of all emotion, all life. The psalmist reaches with his lyric claw to fetch it all in words. Words, words, words. They circle and spin around Western spiritual practice. They abide. They even sustain a way of life, this monastic one, careening down the centuries, creating families, the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Carmelites, and others, with unbroken lineages longer than any royal house in Europe. The pattern of prayer, handed down generation to generation, has sustained this extraordinary lifeline. Words have proven to be more protean than blood. The monastic life of the West cleaves to the Psalms, claiming the ancient Jewish poetry as its real heart, more central to its day than the New Testament or the sacraments. The Psalms keep this life going, the verbal engine running into the deepest recess of Christian social life, and beyond that, back into the source of silence, the desert of the early hermits. The idea here, in this American monastery, based on a 10th century reformation of the earlier Benedictine model, is to wed both traditions, the social monastery and the solitary hermitage, city and desert, public and private. It is a way of life based on a historical pattern. Therefore, this life might be understood as a living memory. It is also a life lived literally within poetry. And as it happens, the name of this prefab hermitage where I have been lodged is Logos, the Word made home, a week in the Word. Against one wall, the single bed, I make it quickly like a good novice first thing every morning, pulling the dorm room spread square. Suitcase stowed beneath, I'm here long enough to want to obscure the truth. I'm a visitor, passing through. I've never liked being a traveler. I take up residence. Found us a chateau yet? You'd say as I scroll through real estate listings for the south of France. I'm going home, I say instinctively, returning to my hotel the first day in a foreign city. So here, Logos is home. Also, a round table, eat, read, write, prop elbows on. Shelves niched in next to the tiny open closet space where I've installed my books, what I could lug on the plane. Montaigne, of course. Also a new novel by someone that someone else said was good, not opened. Poems I have long loved. James Wright, W.S. Merwin. Augustine with his bookmark. Dawson's Religion and the Rise of Western Culture. A dictionary that didn't have the only word I've looked up so far. And Thich Nhat Hanh with yet another volume attempting to calm us Westerners down, out of ourselves. Breathe, feel, exhale. There. And like everybody on a desert island, the Bible, the New Jerusalem version, whether I'll read it or not. A rudimentary kitchen runs along another wall, tiny bathroom beyond that, the only other room, and two windows, one to nowhere, hugged by two crowded eucalyptus trees and the vinca-covered curve of the steep, eroded dirt road I climbed to the chapel. The other window, the window that counts, gives on to paradise. The western rind of America peels off far below into the extravagant white curl of Big Sur. The slant of the Santa Lucia Range, where we are perched, cuts off the view of the coast highway. But the Pacific, blue as steel, it is overcast, or ultramarine on sunny days, appears to be cantilevered below us, a blue platform leading to the end of the world. Sometimes, roughed up by wind and whitecaps, the ocean loses this quality of being architecture. It becomes expensive fabric, shimmering, silvered. Then, simply, what it is, the vast pool brimming to the horizon. This is where I came. There was no crisis, no at the moment heartache or career impasse. You were still there, still in place, holding the fort, you said, waving me off on yet another trip. No dark night except the usual ones. Doesn't everyone wake up maybe two nights a week, mind gunning, palms sweating? In the eyes open misery of night, sensation gets mashed to a paste of meaninglessness, life's or one's own. No anguish beyond that to report. Every so often I just do this. Go on retreat. This is not uncommon in our supposedly secular age. Meditation, massage, monasteries, spas, the postmodern stomach, if not its soul, knows it needs purging. Such places are popular, booked months in advance. Down the coast, the Buddhists were meditating, stemming herbs thoughtfully. Esalen was nearby, too, and the place where Henry Miller discovered the hot tub. I could have gone to the Buddhists, cleansed in the silence, approached the big empty that is the great source. That, after all, is my God. But I came here to follow the Christian monastic day laid out like a garden plot by Benedict at the close of the Roman era. I'm Western. I like my silence sung. The days were silent. The only words were the chanted ones in the chapel, unless I called home. My thin voice sounded odd, insubstantial. When I called, you recited all the messages from my office answering machine. I asked if you were okay. You were. You? Me too. I'm okay. I love you. Me too. I love you. Touching base. The telephone receiver clicked back into its cradle, and the mirage of news and endearments melted. It didn't disappear exactly. I left the telephone room, a little booth by the monastery bookstore, smiling. Your voice in my ear. It's just that conversation in that place, that vacuum, became a bare tissue of meaning, a funny human foible. The midday bell was ringing, and there was something I was trying to remember. That's wrong. I wasn't trying to remember something. More like this. I was being remembered. Being remembered into a memory. Beyond history to the inchoate, still intense trace of feeling that first laid down this pattern. The memory that puts all personal memory in the shade. Praying or chanting the Psalms draws me out of whatever I might be thinking or remembering, for so much thinking is remembering, revisiting, rehearsing. The first morning bell rings at 5:30. I walked up to the chapel in the dead of night dark for vigils, the first round of daily prayers. The chapel is stark, perhaps to some eyes severe. To me, though, the calm of invitation. I bow, as each of the monks does when he enters, toward the dark sanctuary where a candle burns. The honey-colored wood chairs and benches ranked on two sides face each other. They form two barely curved lines, two choirs deftly passing the ball of chant back and forth across the arched room as, somewhere beyond us, the sun rises, and the world begins to exist again. How it was those days. My mind wanders. There are the monks, uniformed into similarity by their cream-colored robes, and yet I manage to wonder about them. Is that one in the back gay? The one with the clipped accent next to me, maybe from Boston? The one on his left looks like a banker, could have been a CEO. Why not? The guy across looks like a truck driver. On and on it goes, my skittery mind. Meanwhile, the psalms keep rolling. A line snags. More than the watchman for daybreak, my whole being hopes in the Lord, and I am pulled along. It's also boring. What happens in the chapel partakes of tedium. It must. The patterns repeat and return. Every 4 weeks, the entire book of Psalms, all 150 poems, is chanted. And then begun again, and again, and again. Sing to the Lord a new song, we have been saying since David was king. This new song rolls from the rise of monotheism, unbroken, across the first millennium, through the second, now the third, the lapidary waves of chant polishing the shore of history. There are men here, there are men and women in monasteries all over the world, repeating this pattern in antiphonal choirs, softly lobbing the same language back and forth to each other. What is this invisible globe they are passing across the space? Worship. But what is worship? It is the practice of the fiercest possible attention. And here, new millennium, the ancient globe of polished words rubbed by a million voices down the centuries, is the filmy glass of memory. Memory understood not as individual story, not as private fragment clutched to the heart, trusted only to the secret page. Even in the midst of high emotion, the rants and effusions that characterize the psalmist's wild compass, there is a curious non-psychological quality to the voice. This is the voice of inner experience. It has no mother, no father. Or it borrows the human family as its one true relation. These words express the memory of the world's longing. Desire so elemental that its shape can only be glimpsed in the incorruptible storehouse of poetic image. He sends his ice crystals like breadcrumbs, and who can withstand that cold? Our days pass by like grass, our prime like a flower in bloom. A wind comes, the flower goes. Paging through a picture book of Christian and Buddhist monasteries in the bookstore, stopped by this cut line accompanying a photograph of a beautiful Buddhist monastery, a remark by a Dogen, "The only truth is we are here now." The physical beauty of the Buddhist place is eloquent, revealing the formal attentiveness of a supreme aesthetic, mindfulness, the human at its best. The food is famous there. They are living their profound injunction, honoring the fleet moment and the smallest life. Buddhist retreatants are asked not to kill the black flies that torment them. Here, when I told the monk at the bookstore that ants were streaming all over the kitchen counter of Logos, he handed me an aerosol canister of Raid, and I was glad. I sprayed, mopped, discarded the little poppy seed carcasses, sat back satisfied, turning again to Montaigne and the mind of the West, figuring. The sweetish spume of bug spray hung in the air for a day. The bug spray has to stop, we know that. Contemplative nuns have told me that without the introduction of Buddhist meditation practice into their own lives, they wouldn't be in the monastery anymore. "It's thanks to Buddhism that I'm a Catholic," one of them said. I have never visited an American Christian monastery that did not have Buddhist meditation mats and pillows somewhere in the chapel. The light touch of the missionary work of the East, the absence of cultural imperialism, the poetry of its gestures. The bell is never struck, never hit. In the Buddhist monastery, it is invited to sound. But still, this handing down of words, this Western practice I would not wish myself out of. The only truth is we are here now. I don't believe we are only here now. How could I, transfixed by memory as I am, believing in the surge of these particular words down the channel of the centuries? Montaigne in his cold tower, I don't portray being, I portray passing. Or the psalmist's way of saying that, I will ponder the story of your wonders. We enter the dark sanctuary, bow to the flame, assemble in the honey-colored chairs again, two halves of the human choir. Some mornings at vigils, before first light, it feels strangely as if our little band, 15 monks, a handful of retreatants, are legion. The two facing choir lines curve slightly, two horizon lines, the bare sketch of a sphere, the world coming into being. We greet first light. We enter dark night. It is all very old, a memory of a memory. It is new as only the day can be new, over and over. The day is a paradox, and we enter it possessed by time's tricky spirit, history and the present instant sublimely transposed. We are here now, the East is chanting from its side of the monastery. And so for now, the West chants in response, the antiphon rising as it has all these centuries out of the ancient memory we inhabit together. Sing a new song. Sing a new song. Alone in a room with words, that's how I've thought of Montaigne in his tower. How I've always thought of writing, anyone writing. Solitude is not only at the heart of writing, it is the heart. These days, months, staring at the screen, notebooks with their crabbed lines, this meddling with writing. A person needs to be alone to do this thing, even if Grace Paley infuriatingly said that she wrote just fine on the train going home to the village after teaching a full load at Sarah Lawrence in Bronxville. But then, there may be no more solitary location in America than a New York subway. Take a look at the faces of those commuters, their heads bent to their open books like monks at their breviaries, little glowing screens casting an otherworldly aura onto their intent faces. They are elsewhere. They are alone. Alone with words as much as any writer at a notebook or screen. A writer even needs to pine for solitude, court it, steal it away from the rest of so-called real life. It's very lover-like, this romance with solitude. It may be the prerequisite that sustains a writing life. More important than talent or discipline, this passion for solitude, the ground upon which the life of the mind roots and blossoms. Solitude is the beguiling, illicit love luring us away from the proper marriage of domestic demands and delights or the civic responsibilities of citizenship. In a moment of great tenderness, I once confessed, I wonder if you remembered this, that I loved living with you. It's like being alone, I said happily. You cocked your beautiful brow and said mildly, I gather that's a compliment. Being alone with another, it's the greatest love transaction. Being alone is, we know, the best chance you have to be yourself, which is in turn the seed of integrity and of any possible originality. I fell hard and early for Rilke's line from his 1904 Letters to a Young Poet, the standard poetic operating manual for me in my 20s. Rilke describes the ideal relationship as a love that consists in this, that two solitudes protect and touch and greet each other. Not until much later did I cock my own brow at this soulful maxim from a man who abandoned his wife and child and spent years mooching around the castles and palaces of admiring countesses and grand dames of the